Mayor Steinberg says Measure U is not about addressing pension liability.
What a waste to take this money and just put it into feeding the machine.
On Insight, my conversation with the mayor was recorded on Tuesday. He thinks the city's Stephon Clark investigation will be wrapped up soon and sent to the DA's office. Prize-winning poet Mary Mackey is here today. She'll read from her new compilation titled The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. Herb Alpert will be at the Gallo Center in Modesto this Sunday. Wait till you hear his conversation with Gary Vercelli. I think you're really going to like this conversation and be surprised by it, too. And at the end of the hour, Jeff Hudson previews fall concerts in the region in Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. People all over the world are watching as Hurricane Florence, now a Category 2 storm, heads toward the East Coast, the Carolinas in particular. People all over the world might be listening to what comes out of the Global Climate Action Summit on the West Coast in San Francisco. Sacramento's Mayor Daryl Steinberg joins leaders from the Australian capital city of Canberra on Friday to host a summit-affiliated event for mid-sized cities. On Tuesday, the mayor came here to the studio and we talked about Measure U, about rent control and the Stephon Clark case. But knowing he'd be at the climate summit today, we started with the city's role.
There'll be 4,000 people from all over the world, and Sacramento's going to play a real part here. I mean, we represent the importance of mid-sized cities in being aggressive about reducing emissions and increasing mobility for people. You know, we were designated as the Green City by Electrify America. We have $44 million to really enhance in a very aggressive way electric vehicle mobility. Mm. Within the next year, we're going to have over 400 EVs on our streets, 260 of them, which people can rent for an hour at a time to go to and fro. We're going to have electric vehicle shuttles from the University of California at Davis into the city of Sacramento so that we can enhance that collaboration around Aggie Square. We want 75,000 electric vehicles by 2025, supported by almost 4,000 public and workplace EV charging stations. That would be 23 times our current number of EVs. And so we're off to a good start with this Electrify America, with what RT is doing. We're not talking about 50 years from now. We're talking about over the next 7 to 8 years. We want to have a bit of a mini revolution here in Sacramento around electrifying our transportation. And next week, Beth, we're going to launch the Mayor's Climate Commission. We're going to do it in collaboration with West Sacramento, Mayor Cabaldon and I. And the goal is to make sure that we take this momentum that is beginning in Greater Sacramento, but we enhance it because we have challenges too. Our region does not get enough of the state cap and trade dollars to subsidize and incentivize our going green. And so
partly because we're not eligible for some of them, correct?
Well, in part, some of it is that the larger areas of the state, the Bay Area and Los Angeles specifically, have just gotten out ahead. And we are a little bit behind. And, you know, I still, one of the reasons I think I won the mayor's race is because people expected that given my relationships at the State House and my history, that we would be able to bring in more money for Sacramento. And we have in a lot of areas, certainly around homelessness. And again, this Green City designation through the Air Resources Board, $44 million. But on cap and trade specifically, we can do better. And the Climate Commission, in part, I hope, will position us to show that we are ready to take the next step and to bring more green resources, cap and trade dollars, into Sacramento.
On the subject of revenue for the city, let's talk about Measure U, because that's a very homegrown revenue stream.
My favorite topic. The city voters passed a Measure U half cent in 2012, at the end of the recession, in order to stop the bleeding and the cutting of vital city services. And Measure U has worked, and it's worked phenomenally. When you look at the statistics and you look at the number of parks workers that have been increased, the fact that 12 swimming pools and 5 standalone wading pools that were closed during the recession are now open, restoring almost 100 police officers to the force, ending the fire service brownouts that jeopardized public safety. There's a great story to tell there. But of course, I'm asking not only to continue what has worked, but also to take that other half cent, which, by the way, is a quarter cent net, because the state sales tax has gone down a quarter. So it's really a net advance of an additional quarter cent, to use it to invest in what I call inclusive economic development in our city. What do I mean?
Do you mean housing? Do you mean,
because
I think that's...
I mean high-wage job creation. I mean affordable housing, including homelessness. And I mean investing in young people. And I mean art and culture in our neighborhoods. Those are the four categories.
What's on the top of that list for you?
Well, I think it's high-wage job creation, because we must diversify our economy. We need people to be trained, educated, and be working in high-wage industries, because that in part is what's going to solve our housing crisis, in addition to more supply and making sure that existing tenants are treated fairly. We have great dreams and great aspirations, and we have tremendous amount of need, because there is an economic divide between all the excitement, but the people in the neighborhoods who are left out. You know, our poverty rate is too high. Our poverty rate grew higher than all but 7 cities in the country between 2012 and 2016. Three quarters of the new jobs in this region require high level of digital skills. And if you look at the number of African Americans and Latinos, for example, who don't have those high levels of education, we need to be aggressive about changing that. When you look at the commercial corridors in our city, Del Paso Boulevard, Stockton, Franklin, these are the centers of much of our history and our diversity. And yet for decades, we've planned a plan. And there's a lot of blight. And it's about time that we have the capital, and that's the key word, the capital, to invest in high-wage job creation, in affordable housing, including homelessness, and investing in our youth. And we currently don't have it.
The criticism of Measure U speaks exactly to what you're saying, which is the people that you're talking about are going to be hit the hardest, this regressive tax criticism.
Well, I understand the criticism, and I acknowledge the sales tax is regressive, but local governments don't have other tools, frankly. That's the limitation that the state and the state constitution has placed on us. But here's the way that I answer it. Number one, it's only a quarter cent net increase because the state sales tax has gone down. But secondly, it's our obligation to return the bulk of that investment to the neighborhoods and to the communities.
Let me ask you a question that's in tandem with this.
So yes.
Without a guarantee for where Measure U funds will go, and because of the structure of voting, you're actually prohibited from giving a guaranteed destination, there is a strong belief that the majority of this money will end up eventually going to the pension liability, that it'll be diverted to solve that crisis and not to these challenged corridors that you so much want to help in the city.
I would not put forward this bold proposal to spend it on filling the pension. I wouldn't do it. I have always been a politician that has lived up to his word. And we are going to, again, put forward a series of evaluation metrics before the election that show that this mission of investing in inclusive economic development in our neighborhoods, in job growth, in affordable housing, is, in fact, the mission. And finally, I fundamentally believe, and maybe it's an old-fashioned notion, that the only way over time we're going to deal with the pension problem and long-term deficits is twofold. Number one, we're going to have serious conversations with our hardworking public employees about being able to respect them always, but having to afford what we can in the end provide. By the way, I did that in 2012 when I was pro tem of the Senate. I helped lead the effort with Governor Brown to begin reforming the state's pension system, so I'm not shy about it. But there's a second real old-fashioned notion. The only way we're going to deal with deficits in the future is to grow a modern economy and to actually grow a tax base. What a waste to take this money and just put it into feeding the machine. Look, I did not come back to run for mayor. We've talked about this before. After serving at the highest levels of state government, to put forward a bold proposal to put all the money into fixing pensions, it's not what I came to do. And so I want to lead a renaissance that allows us to actually match our dreams and our needs with the resource base, the capital, to be able to actually build a modern economy. And the public sector, in partnership with the private sector, we can take this not just the next level, but the next several levels and create more opportunity for our people.
I am talking with Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg. Measure U will be on the November ballot. So will Prop 10, the statewide rent control measure. So are you looking for now at Measure U running somewhat separately from the discussion of rent control?
It's a separate issue. And look, I'm being a little provocative here because I feel like I must. If we don't provoke a real discussion about how we deal with the housing crisis in Sacramento, then a lot of people are going to get hurt. A lot of people are getting hurt.
Is a real discussion not yet happening?
It's beginning to happen. But, you know, I think what happens in politics oftentimes is that people get in and organizations get in their camps and say, no way will we do X, Y, or Z.
So what's happening? What core are we not yet getting to?
So here's the thing. SEIU and the housing advocates have put out a very strong rent control measure for the 2020 ballot. It would impose permanent rent control. And I've been very clear, I'm not comfortable with that. Right. I don't think that's right for Sacramento. The business side has said we don't want rent caps of any kind under any circumstances. And so I put forward an idea which essentially says, well, I don't want permanent rent control. So I put out a temporary rent cap, a 3-year rent cap. And by the way, only on buildings 20 years or older, which is where most of the lower to lower middle income people live. Exempt new construction. So controversial. And then a couple of my colleagues put out an idea, I think because I'm prompting the discussion, that says, well, why don't we guarantee 18-month leases? And I thought that was constructive. And so now what we try to do is meld the best of my idea, the best of their ideas, and we do the art of politics here, which is actually doing something, I hope, that will not only be responsible and not hurt the economic renaissance in any way and continue to incentivize supply, but also genuinely protect as many of those thousands of people as we can who are every bit as much Sacramentans as anybody else.
Let me shift topics for a moment. There was another officer-involved shooting of an African-American man in Sacramento this month.
Yes.
Will you comment on these continuing instances of violence in the city?
Well, anytime there's a shooting and anytime anybody loses their life, it's a tragedy. And your heart always goes out to the loved ones of anyone who has lost their life. But each of these incidents need to be seen, I think, on their own facts. And once again, I commend our police department and Chief Hahn because we are living transparency, right? The videos get out quickly. The public gets a chance to see. And again, I always am loath to comment on any particular investigation, but in the case last week, it appeared that the individual who lost his life was waving some sort of a gun. And so the investigations need to be completed. I am pleased, though, that the police department has been pretty aggressive, for example, in changing the city's police foot pursuit policy. I'm glad that foot pursuit now will be seen, will be used less. I'm very happy about some of the transparency measures. But look, it Measure U is in part, frankly, a response to all of this, because while we continue to work on changing the police practices and continue to spread the implied racism training, which is really crucial, we have got to be deliberate and intentional about addressing systemic poverty in the best way we can. Because what came out of Stephon Clark, more than anything else, was the generational trauma and the fear and the lack of hope. I want us to have the capacity and the capital to be able to invest in people's lives, to be able to invest in our neighborhoods, our communities of color, so that we begin changing some of the dynamics that lead to terrible tragedies.
September 18th marks 6 months since the Stephon Clark shooting. The investigation is still with its originating agencies. The case hasn't moved to the district attorney's office yet. What about the time process of the investigation? A community wanting answers and this waiting period?
Well, as I understand it, the investigation is going to be wrapped up very, very soon, and that the findings will be sent to the district attorney. So I think we're at the final stages here. And I understand people's anxiousness and even frustration. On the other hand, I would rather that the investigation be thorough, and that when people see the report, it will be based upon people will know that the thousands of hours necessary on the forensic side, that all that work has been done and done in the right way. And I'm very pleased that the state legislature sent the bill to the governor, which I hope he will sign, that will make the findings of these investigations more public than they are now. I think that was one of the most troubling things about the current process, is that even at the end of an investigation, the public doesn't have a right to see or to know. And that's not right. And I think if the governor signs that bill, at least a significant part of that will change.
Mayor Steinberg, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Beth.
My conversation with the mayor was recorded Tuesday. The Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn has since told me there isn't a specific date for the completion of the Stephon Clark investigation. This Sunday, by the way, is the launch of Compassionate Sacramento and 916 Day, which has evolved since the Clark shooting. You can find a link to more information on our website. And one more note, the campaign for Measure U tells us that there have been three polls done since August of 2017 asking about Measure U. The support rate has stayed, we're told, between 58 and 62%. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The latest poetry collection by Mary Mackey does include some new work, but the book is titled for a poem that was included in Sugar Zone, her collection that won the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award in 2012. That title is The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. And Mary will launch this book with an event tonight at 7 o'clock at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento. I'm so glad that she's made time to be with us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this book, which is getting some remarkable attention and praise.
Yes, and you know, the first edition sold out the first day it was out there, so we're now into the second edition, which is, it was a small first edition, but that's phenomenal for a poetry book, so I'm surprised, actually.
You have talked about how the world for poetry has been expanding, but there is something about finding the essence of a voice. Mm-hmm. So in what you just said about this book and the world of poetry being so big, What do you think people are connecting to?
I think, well, I like poetry to be accessible and understandable and at the same time beautiful and lyrical and uncompromising with complexity and depth of emotion. And I think because my poems are actually accessible and understandable and not like crossword puzzles, I think people are finding in them what they've always loved in poetry.
So with that, I'm going to get back to jaguars in a moment.
Sure.
But let's go to one of your poems, which I asked you to read because for me, it sticks inside of me. It's titled "L Tells All." I think we need a little context for this poem. And then with that poem, I think everybody will understand what you're saying about the clarity, the lack of obscurity, I'll put it that way.
Okay. L Tells All. This is about Leda and the Swan. And the most famous poem about this is the Yeats poem about the Greek myth that Zeus becomes a giant swan and goes down and basically rapes a young woman named Leda. And she gives birth to an egg, which becomes Helen of Troy, which I think is very interesting. I never liked this poem when I was a young woman because of the rape aspect of it. And so I decided to write a poem that told Leda's side of the story. And so this is Leda's answer to what really happened. And this is called L Tells All. And it's kind of like a supermarket tabloid that you'd see up against the wall. L Tells All. I wanted a man, but they were in short supply. So when this big white swan followed me home and announced, "I am Zeus, Lord of all creation," I crooked my finger at him and said, "Come here, bird boy, let's give it a try." At first, I have to admit it was fun. His soft breast, the excited squawk, the way he beat his wings frantically, like an umpire gone bad. But basically, it was an act of desperation. We had nothing in common. His feathers made me sneeze. I was afraid to fly. He was married. Of course, they all are. We even had religious differences. What can I say? And then there were his other women, Io, Europa, Semele, not to mention the sluttish little pens he picked up in the park. We started to have terrible fights. I called him an overstuffed pillow. He threw seed in my face and threatened to migrate. The usual stuff. By spring, we'd both had enough. One night, while we were sitting in a Greek restaurant, I told the old cob I'd always be his friend, but I just couldn't handle interspecies love. I lied, of course. The truth was, I had already started to see a duck on the side.
There is so much good stuff in that poem. And I think in the midst of the Me Too movement, it sounds different.
Yes, it
means something different.
It does mean something different. And a lot of the poems, some of these poems were written in 1974, the second wave women's movement. They sound like they could have been written today, which is both a bad and a good thing. You know, it's just amazing to me that they were so fresh when I went back and looked at them.
So let's go back in time a little bit. I said Sugar Zone was from 2012, but the poems, including the title poem, are from a couple decades of your life that you spent in Brazil.
Yes. I've been going to Brazil for the last 25 years with my husband just about every year. And then before that, when I was a young woman in my 20s, I lived for about 6 years off and on in the rainforests of Costa Rica at a biological field station. So I've had a lot of experience in the jungles of the tropics.
So the title poem, "The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams," it's written partly in Portuguese. Brazilian Portuguese is almost a second language now for you, isn't it?
My doctorate's in comparative literature, and so I had Spanish and French. And then when I started going to Brazil, I learned Portuguese, and I fell in love with the language. It's a beautiful language. They have beautiful music. And I like to use it in my poetry, but if you don't understand it, you don't need to, because all of the poems are written so they could be understood in English. This is what I mean by accessible. And then the Portuguese will become for you a kind of a chant, almost a religious chant background to it. But if you speak Spanish or Portuguese or French even, or maybe even Romanian, romance languages, you'll get a little extra flip with the Portuguese in
the
language.
Well, maybe we should hear this poem then.
Okay.
You do mention the names of rivers, and there are some words that, like you said, aren't necessary to know.
Right. This is called "The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams." The first words are the rivers, names of rivers, tributaries of the Amazon. The last names are names of indigenous tribes of people who no longer exist, mostly destroyed by disease when the Europeans entered the Amazon. And this is from the Amazon. "The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams." Up on the Orinoco, Rio Negro, Solimões, Tocantins, Xingu, Javaré,
They're drinking the bebida preta, black drink, snake vine, ayahuasca yage blood of the great anaconda, with the smoke of burning rainforests in their nostrils and gosto de cenizas, taste of ashes, on their tongues. Eles está comendo, they're eating, purple snails, powdered viper venom, largatas esmagadas, flowers that dye their lips the color of blood, singing of cities of blue glass, and the jaguars that prowl our dreams. Uke mice, what else are they seeing? Uke mice, what else do they know? They're not saying. They're not telling. They're calling on the ghost tribes instead. Ghosts of the Tupinimba, Tupanquin, Amare, lost upriver, forever lost in the burning world.
That's Mary Mackey, and she is launching her collection of poetry that is titled for the name of that poem that she just read, The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, in Sacramento at Time Tested Books. 7 o'clock, there is a poetry reading and book signing. You have a few special guests with you tonight, including Professor Josh McKinney.
You know, he's not going to be able to make it, but I think Professor Bradley Buchanan will be coming in. So.
Okay. Tell me about the jaguar, its symbolism. The jaguar shows up in a few of your poems.
Yeah, it prowls my poems as well as my dreams. I think it's a symbol of the ultimate mystery, both of nature and the mysteries in ways of life. It's a symbol of sudden, unexpected things that human beings can't control. It's somewhat a symbol of death that prowls, but it's also a symbol of the unexpected, the raw power of nature, the nature that goes beyond the power of people to control it. Mm-hmm. And I think it sort of has a little relationship to Blake's Tiger Burning Bright, you know, mm-hmm. William Blake's poem, Tiger, Tiger Burning Bright. So
there are different sections in this book, Mary. There's a Shakespeare section. There's a whole group of poems from Time in Kentucky.
Yes, there are. Yeah.
And there are poems that speak to nature and a lot that focus on saving the planet. And the fact that we have you here while this climate summit is going on in San Francisco is a wonderful bit of serendipity.
Yes, and it's a long time preoccupation with me. It's possibly the longest in my poetry because I spent time in the rainforest of Costa Rica, and 90% of where I was has been chopped down and turned into charcoal or lumber. I've seen the destruction of the forest from the time I was a very young woman, and I've been very, very interested in ecological issues and issues of conservation, and I've watched the world walk toward a destruction that I find, upsetting. And I try to capture it in my poetry. I try to capture the beauty of what we're losing, not just the tragedy, because I think we need to understand we're preserving something very precious and very beautiful at the same time, and something far beyond us in many ways.
How often are you writing a poem now? How much are you writing?
Well, I write every day, and I write poems when they come to me. I wrote some of these poems. I write my poems, and I spend a lot of time revising them. So I write pretty much, I'd say 5 days a week.
I think that if there are any young writers, any students, anyone fascinated with poetry but just learning about it who can come to your event tonight, I think hearing you talk and read and explain a bit about your process is really important for people.
Yeah, and I'm also happy to answer questions from the audience. So.
All right. Well, congratulations on this book. Thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me on Insight.
That is Mary Mackey. And again, the book is The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. She will be at Time Tested Books in Midtown Sacramento tonight at 7 o'clock. This is Insight on CAP Radio.
You see this guy, this guy's in love with you.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, and that's the song in 1968 that gave Herb Alpert a number one Billboard pop song as a vocalist. Then fast forward to 79, and in 1979, he landed a Billboard number one as an instrumentalist with the song Rise. He's 83 years old now. He's won 9 Grammys, sold more than 72 million records. And at one point, his Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass had 4 records in the top 10 at the same time. He has launched many other superstars in the music world, too, as you're about to hear in a conversation. Herb Alpert and his wife, vocalist Lonnie Hall, will be at the Gallo Center in Modesto this Sunday, September 16th. So Herb Alpert talked with Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, remembering his trips across the Mexican border in his 20s and how those experiences led to the first album of his remarkable career, The Lonely Bull.
I used to go to bullfights in Tijuana, which is not too far from where I live. And I got caught up in the feeling of the event. You know, I never listened to mariachi music, but up in the stands there was a brass band, and they used to introduce the different events, like ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and the bull would come charging out, and then they'd have another fanfare, and the matador would come out, and I don't know, I just tried to translate that feeling that I got into music, so that's what happened. That was The Lonely Bull. That was a song written by a friend of mine. I adapted it to suit this feeling that I had. And that record took off like a rocket ship.
Wow. When you ran A&M Records with Jerry Moss, The Carpenters were one of your biggest hits. And you signed The Carpenters, correct?
Yeah, I signed Richard and Karen in 1970, maybe late 69. They continue to sell records. God bless her. Karen was an extraordinary talent.
Why do birds suddenly appear?
She didn't really know how great she was, unfortunately. She'd always say, my strength is a drummer. When I met them, Karen was playing drums.
Yeah.
And luckily for them and us, I gave them Close to You, that song that was their major breakthrough song.
Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be close to you. On the day that you...
Did you have any idea that Close to You was going to explode the way The Lonely Bull did?
I have no idea. You never know. You know, it's like you leave it up to the public. You try to make the best record you can and then leave it at that. Now, there's no way of knowing. You know, people used to come into A&M and they'd have a master recording. If you liked it, you could sign them. So this artist came in with this record, and then I hated it. It was, like, too long. I thought it was out of tune. I just didn't like listening to it. I turned it down. Well, it turned out to be Louie Louie.
Oh, wow.
That's one that got away.
Herb, I want to talk to you about your long-term partnership with Lonnie Hall, and I want to know how you met her.
Oh, well, Lonnie's an angel. We've been married for 44 years. I met her in 1966. I auditioned Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66 in 1966 for A&M Records. We signed them. Sergio was opening the show for the Tijuana Brass. And at that time, we were playing for, you know, 20,000 people at a time in big arenas. And Lonnie and I became friends, and I just really appreciated her authenticity and her singing, man. She's a world-class singer. She gives you goosebumps, and she's an amazing human being.
One more question about Sergio Mendes. I heard his albums before he came to A&M Records, and they were pretty much straight jazz albums. They didn't sell very well. Did you get him to get in touch with his Brazilian roots or to take the new Brazil 66 image?
Well, Sergio had a group called Brazil 65, and he was going to disband that group because it wasn't happening, and he was going to take one more shot at it because Brazil 65, he had Brazilian artists involved with him, and he said he was going to kind of Americanize it a little bit and give it one more shot, call it Brazil 66. He met my wife. She was singing at a club in Chicago, and he fell in love with her sound and asked her to be the lead singer. The first song that we worked on was Mashkinada, which became a pretty good seller and also was popular in the clubs. But when Sergio had it, he had it at a really extremely fast tempo. And I said, no, man, we got to slow this baby down. You're playing this thing for hummingbirds. You know, it doesn't work. So we slowed it down, and we got it into the groove, and that just became one of the catalysts that catapulted Sergio and the group. But it didn't hurt that he was opening the show for us for 20,000 people at a time.
Mashkinada, sai da minha frente que eu quero passar, pois o samba está animado, o jogueiro em samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu, em samba de preto veio, samba de preto do. Mashkinada, samba como esta também.
Herb, you took up the trumpet at age 8, and you're also a painter. When did you start painting, and do they share a common creative gestalt?
Oh, yeah. I've been painting for close to 50 years now, and when I was traveling around the world with the Tijuana Brass, I used to go to museums. Always intrigued by the modern art section, and I saw paintings that touched me, and I returned home, bought a canvas and some paints, and started moving paint around like a monkey, you know, just kind of going for a feeling. And I just continued doing it, and little by little it started to evolve into something that was really giving me a lot of pleasure. And a gallery owner happened to see my work, and he wanted to show the work, and this was years back. And one thing led to another, and then I started sculpting, and the same thing happened there. It's been an incredible journey for me. I mean, I have 9 huge sculptures at the Field Museum in Chicago. I mean, from 14 to 17 and a half foot totems in bronze.
Do you ever feel like, well, I'm sculpting, I could be playing the trumpet, or I'm playing the trumpet, I could be painting?
No, not really. I mean, I have time to do all three, and you know, one of my great loves is to record. When I got into producing records, when I met the great Sam Cooke, and I learned a lot from him, although he didn't realize he was teaching me anything at the time. But I just got intrigued by that whole way of putting music together.
Don't know much about history.
Herb, did you write Wonderful World for Sam Cooke?
Well, I wrote Wonderful World with Sam Cooke and Lou Adler, and Sam was brilliant. He was special. He had magic dust on him. You know, he was the lead singer with a very famous gospel group, and he just had this honest way of presenting himself as an artist. It was beautiful to watch, and I tell this story now and then about, you know, he used to carry around this notebook with him with all the lyrics that he was going to write music to, and he showed me this one lyric. He says, Herbie, what do you think of this lyric here? And when I looked at it, man, it was like the corniest lyric I have ever seen in my entire life. I didn't say that to him, but I just couldn't believe it that he was going to write a song over that. I said, well, what's the song sound like? Well, he did have the song, and he picked up his guitar, started singing this thing with this, I thought, corny lyric, and all of a sudden the thing turned into magic. I mean, it was like his intent, his passion, where he put the notes, the melody that he chose, the rhythm. I mean, it was an eye opener for me. It just made me realize it ain't what you do, it's the way how you do it. And he had the way to do it.
We're having a party, dancing to the music played by the DJ.
Were the lyrics, the Cokes are in the ice box?
Absolutely, that was it.
The Cokes are in the ice box. Popcorn's on the table.
Couldn't be any cornier, but man, when he sang it, I mean, it was like, real a moment for me.
So, Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time dancing with my baby.
Do you still practice the trumpet every day? Because it's kind of an unforgiving instrument, isn't it?
It's a beautiful instrument. It's... I do it every day just about, but not because I have to. I just love it. I mean, I started playing when I was 8 years old. I had this incredible experience in my grammar school. There was a music appreciation class. And they had a table filled with various instruments. I happened to pick up the trumpet, and it was talking for me because I'm an introvert, basically. And as a kid, I was pretty mute. It's obviously changed my life, and I work very hard with the Herb Alpert Foundation to make sure that kids have some type of creative experience at an early age. I think it's so important to be a core part of kids' education.
Well, I read that you wrote a rather large check to keep a school in Harlem operational.
They were closing their doors. They were out of funds. We did some research on it, and I just couldn't imagine a school from Harlem, which gave us so many great musicians, and the energy in that whole area was so spectacular. I couldn't imagine it going out of business. So we made some changes. Yes, we invested some money in it, and we changed the management a bit, and it all worked out great. It turns out now it's one of the best things I've ever done with the Herb Alpert Foundation.
Herb, you have an upcoming release, a retake on A Taste of Honey?
Well, I got a different take on all those songs, all those evergreens, called Reimagined Tijuana Brass. So I took some of those songs, which I was reluctant to do because I didn't think I could add anything to those songs, but got together with Joachim Vandersag, who got a little different take than working with me on them. It's always been intriguing for me to take a song that people recognize, and can I do it in a different way that they haven't heard quite that way before? And that was my pursuit, and it came off really well. I think anybody picks up this project, I think they will appreciate that.
New album again is Reimagined Tijuana Brass. You just heard Gary Vercelli talking with Herb Alpert, who will be at the Gallo Center for the Arts in Modesto this Sunday, September 16th. There's more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There is a rich season of concerts and plays in the region this fall. Cap Radio's arts and theater critic Jeff Hudson is here with a preview. And Jeff, I understand you're going to start, though, with a few newsier items.
Right. One of the Sacramento area orchestras, the Camellia Symphony, is about to start their season in a different venue than they've been in recent years. They are moving into the recently renovated McClatchy High Auditorium, which has several hundred more seats.
Yeah, that's great.
And so consequently, you'll be able to buy tickets the day of the performance, probably. They start their season, the Camellia Symphony Orchestra, on September the 29th with pianist Natsuki Fukusawa. And then last Friday, our region lost Barbara Jackson, who was the music lover and philanthropist from Davis.
Right.
She is the reason that Jackson Hall at the Mondavi Center is named Jackson Hall. It's named after her late husband and herself. She donated also lots of big donations to the San Francisco Opera and to other organizations. And she was 99 years old.
Yeah, just 1 month short of turning
100. I know. And I've spoken with her, and it's going to be different going into Jackson Hall without seeing her up there in her favorite box. But she's a wonderful, wonderful figure.
Yeah, a lot of gratitude to her family. All right, let's move on to some of these concerts, starting with the Sacramento Chamber Music Society.
Which is coming right up on Saturday the 15th and Sunday the 16th. The first one, the Saturday in Davis and the Sunday at Sac State. They are having in Philip Myers, who for 37 years, which is a long time, was the principal horn with the New York Philharmonic. And he is, I've heard him here several times. He's really, really good, and I'm looking forward to hearing this concert myself. Phil Myers has been a friend of Bill Barbini, who's the artistic director of the, you know, forever. They were both in the New York Philharmonic in the 70s. And he's going to be here playing a Mozart quintet for horn, two violas and cello, and then a Beethoven sextet, and the Brahms horn trio. And let's hear a little bit of the Brahms horn trio featuring Philip Myers.
Such a distinctive instrument, isn't
right.
it?
Right. And he's very good.
So those concerts are this weekend.
Right.
We have more on our website. All right, to the Stockton Symphony.
The Stockton Symphony is starting up their season, and they are bringing in a soloist, Anthony Trionfo, who is a flutist. Now, if you think you might have heard that name, Anthony Trionfo, on the airwaves here before, he's been on From the Top twice, back when he was a teenager.
Oh.
And so he's originally from Las Vegas, and he's African-American, and he's a really, really fine flutist. I'm impressed with his work. He is currently a grad student at the Colburn School of Music right next to Walt Disney Hall in Los Angeles. And with the Stockton Symphony, he's going to be playing the Jockey Bear Flute Concerto, which he hasn't recorded yet. So I found a foray fantasy for flute that he's performing on. Let's hear a little bit of how he plays the flute. And also on the Stockton Symphony's concert is going to be a brand new piece commissioned from Emmy Award-winning composer John Wineglass by the Stockton Symphony, and it's called The Sights and Sounds of Stockton. It's a multimedia thing with some visual film pieces from the Stockton area by students from San Joaquin Delta College. That concert is going to be on September 22nd.
Wow. To hear that is one thing, but to watch it live would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right, let's keep going, Jeff.
Well, Maria Callas is sort of visiting the Mondavi. The Mondavi Center is going to be doing Callas in Concert, the Hologram Tour, on September the 23rd. Maria Callas, as opera fans all know, was the reigning soprano that was on top of the world in the 1950s and 1960s. She passed away quite a while ago in 1977. Back in the 60s, operas were not recorded for TV broadcast very often, so we don't have archival footage of her singing complete operas to speak of. There's just a little bit. But she did do some television specials, and what's happened is a company called Bass Hologram has taken some of those old TV specials, reprocessed the video into a hologram, and then remastered the sound. So the image of Maria Callas will be there on stage, the sound of Maria Callas's voice will be there, and then there will be an actual orchestra. The Sacramento Philharmonic has been hired for the night. They've got a conductor coming in to lead them. And so it's going to be a very unusual. It's the only way, it's as close as you're going to get to seeing what Maria Callas was like.
Wouldn't that be tempting if you were a musician to want to be watching to try?
Well, and you
I don't know what your view would be from stage of the hologram process.
Callas's fans are really, really dedicated. And so the people who are just always interested in anything she did are going to want to check this one out.
Yeah, September 23rd at 7 o'clock at the Mondavi Center.
Right.
Right. Okay, we have time for one more.
There is a group from the Ukraine that is going to be visiting the Harris Center on October the 2nd. And this is a group called Daka Braka, and they've been creating quite a stir in avant-garde circles. They sort of do a one-of-a-kind blend of traditional instruments and music from different parts of the world, and they perform, the three women in the quartet wear these really crazy-looking tall black hats that are, you got to see it. They've been on, they've done a tiny music concert, and that video is out there on the internet. Their blend of wild energy and spirited anarchy is kind of what I think of them as. Kind of reminds me a little bit of the B-52s, but from Eastern Europe and more into the folky end of things. Let's hear a little bit of Daka Braka.
Okay, Jeff, you have our producers and Anthony Van Hook, our engineer, dancing in the room. I'm seeing it through the glass.
I can safely predict that this is something a little bit different than anything else you've ever seen. And again, it's
like it.
Yeah. No, I was having fun, you know, chopping onions to it in the kitchen, too.
Ah.
So they're coming up October the 2nd at the Harris Center. I should also mention, since we have just a second, there are three Shakespeare openings coming up. This weekend, the Actors Theater is opening up King Lear with Ed Claudio in the title role.
Uh-huh.
The following weekend, the 21st, Davis Shakespeare is opening up As You Like It. And then at the end of the month, New Idea Theater is opening up Othello.
Wow. And they're all great productions, too. So that's Insight for today. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Thanks to Paul Conley and Gary Vercelli for their work on the Herb Alpert piece. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow.